The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
This morning we continue our work with the Lojong teachings, which are teachings on generating compassion and resilience. Norm Fisher says that we have adapted or borrowed from the Tibetan tradition, and actually it's Norman Fisher, who's a Zen teacher in the San Francisco Zen Center tradition, who's done the adapting for us, and we're following him and also looking back at some of the commentators in the Tibetan tradition. And we've been in point three, which is transform bad circumstances into the path. And now we may go back there because we're doing a bit of back and forth, but today I felt pulled towards talking about point four, so we're introducing a new section, which is called Make Practice Your Whole Life. And I'll talk specifically about slogan 17, cultivate a serious attitude, which traditionally in the Tibetan tradition is practice the five strengths. And we may do three or four of them, maybe five. So I was drawn to make practice your whole life because here we are, and we've been practicing together here for 9 days, and so, yeah, practice has been my whole life. And this is the longest that I've been on retreat. I've done a number of the seven-day sesshins that we have here in summer, but never pushed past that, and it's really different. And, you know, this is something I've wanted to do. For a long time. So it's hard because the hard thing is I have to leave tonight. I'm coming back. Don't worry. You'll still have a shuso. But when I'm not wearing my cape, which is what I'm calling my roksu right now, when I'm not wearing my cape, I'm a mild-mannered college professor. And spring term starting. And I've got some sophomores and some upperclassmen that need me to introduce them to poetry and the Gothic novel. And so I've got to make this transition tomorrow. And I don't know how I'm going to do it. And when I do it, I'm going to try to continue this practice. And wow, that's what this slogan's about. Make practice your whole life. So let's go backwards. Why is it I wanted to do this for so long? Like maybe some of you, I came to this practice really young. I mean young for an American. I was just 17. And I encountered the Dharma, you know, in that accidental way. It seems accidental that we all do. And it caught on. And, you know, we're talking about 1971, 1972. There weren't very many opportunities for Americans who were not heritage Buddhists to study the Dharma. There weren't resources. There were just, you know, there were a few scattered things. And initially, and this has been really interesting for me to go back to this week, initially I started in the Tibetan tradition because I found one friend who was even younger than me. I was 17, he was 16. And he also was drawn to Buddhism. And he was quite resourceful. And he found out that there was this Tibetan Lama living in Seattle, where we live. Not terribly far from where we live. And I didn't know it, but he was actually a great Tibetan teacher that's kind of famous, named Deshun Rinpoche. And so he said, well, let's go to his house. Like, wow, that's what, when you're 17 or 16, you can do those things. Yeah, let's go to this guy's house. And we did. And he didn't speak a word of English. But his grandson was there, who was very Americanized. His grandson had a painting business. And he's looking at us, holding our white claws, thinking, who are these geeks that want to talk to my grandfather? But he was actually very sweet and translated. And we ended up taking the refuges with Deshun. And he taught us how to meditate and how to do prostrations and chants. You had to do hundreds of times, thousands of times. So, okay, now I'm a Buddhist. This is what I wanted. But it was hard to work with a teacher who couldn't speak your language. And it was hard to have a practice with just one person in your sangha. And my 16-year-old friend was a little bit flaky anyway, kind of phasing in and out of it. So I decided I needed a sangha. I had learned that much about Buddhism. And so one day I put out my thumb and hitchhiked to San Francisco and went to the San Francisco Zen Center. And I had some money that had been put in an account for me when I was a baby or something. And I used that and became a guest student. And I was now trained in Zen in the good old days at San Francisco Zen Center, when you always sat for 40 minutes facing the white wall. And so I sat like Bodhidharma facing the wall, not for 9 years, but for 9 months. And not all day, but three or four 40-minute periods a day. And, you know, something happened. And I thought that would be my life. But I'm not saying anything most people don't know when I say there were problems brewing at the San Francisco Zen Center, and it would implode, you know, some years later and then right itself and go on. But I didn't know what was going on, but I felt that there was something wrong, and it was very hard to be 18 years old in this really weird atmosphere that was developing already just a year and a half after Shunryu Suzuki Roshi's death. And so I left, and it was really hard. That was hard to do. But I left, and I kept sitting by myself for a while. My friend by now was gone. And I didn't think to go back to Deshun Rinpoche's house. And yet, this experience it stuck with me, didn't go away. And I had an opening into what we've been talking about under the in the Lojong, under the heading of absolute bodhicitta, absolute awakening of the heart mind. And we touched on it in the Song of Zazen. All beings by nature are Buddha, and apart from Buddha, no beings. And we say at the beginning of the dedication, and this keeps coming up, all living things are one seamless body and pass quickly from dark to dark. And this is what we paradoxically call emptiness, but then sometimes say, well, maybe it should be called fullness. And having glimpsed this, it might seem like I forgot it, because I let my practice tail off. And I decided, here was an idea, I decided to go to college. I was just, you know, I was 19 years old now, 18 years old, I could still do that. I'd taken 2 years away from college. I deferred my admission. I thought I was going to be a monk at Tassajara, so I almost didn't defer it the second year, but my brother made me. And so I went to college, and I found something that I really loved, and I got kind of good at it. Actually, I won't be modest, I got really good at it. And if in college there's a field that you love and you're good at it, often your professors will say, oh, you can be one of us. And so I got that idea in my head. I went to graduate school and I managed to get a tenure track job at a time when the job crisis that's still ongoing had already started. I was very fortunate. And then I was even more fortunate and got a job at Boston College and could come back to this area where I'd done my graduate training. And all this time I didn't sit. And it was partly for a good reason and partly for a bad reason. That speaks to this topic, make practice your whole life. The good reason was, once I had left the Zen Center and I had put away the fantasy of being a monk doing stuff like we're doing now all the time. But was it a fantasy? Well, in my case, it seemed to be. So once that had happened, I decided I didn't want to just sit so that I'd be a little happier or a little calmer. I didn't want to instrumentalize. That's how I put it to myself. I'm not going to instrumentalize Zen. I'm either going to, be a monk devoted to saving all beings, or I'm just not going to do it. No halfway for this guy. And so the good impulse was, I didn't fall for this 10% happier thing. Yeah, there wasn't a mindfulness industry then, but people were already peddling it. And having gotten this taste, no, I wasn't about that. But where I was wrong was I had entered into the mind of division. I thought that I could be a monk or I could be a regular guy, but nothing in between. I didn't see how I could have a lay practice and be serious about it, which is partly why I'm so devoted to lay practice, I'll even spar with my old teacher here sometimes over its tradition. And that's where that comes from. So I got my PhD and I got my lovely job at Boston College. And I married a lovely wife and we had lovely children. And sounds pretty good. My career went well. I stepped back once it was established, and her career went really well. And living the life, but no. Because I was not living my real life. David once said at a retreat, "Who wants to be a ghost?" Who wants to live that insubstantial life? And so something prodded me. And things had gotten pretty messed up. at home, and I couldn't fix it. So, in the nicest way possible, I left. And I didn't take much with me. And I rented this really spacious, really dilapidated apartment in Waltham. And had more room than I'd ever had to myself, ever. Which was kind of nice, you know. And started over. And now, this is how strange life is. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. So I have this big empty place with just basically my old graduate school stuff in it. And my son had, who was now 13, my son had, loved San Francisco. We would go there. My wife's parents, my now ex-wife's parents, lived there, and he loved Chinatown. And he decided he wanted a Buddha. He thought that it would be cool. And so, yeah, so he got a Buddha. And then here I am in my empty apartment, and I thought, well, if my son has a Buddha, I should have a Buddha. I mean, I'm a Buddhist. I've got a Tibetan Buddhist name. I was at the San Francisco Zen Center. I'm not going to let my son be the only one with a Buddha. So, and now, my story's going to sound like some quaint independent movie for a while, and I apologize for that. But I have to tell you what really happened, and I can't change it to make it seem like it was real. You know, so you'll just have to bear with me. But I remembered seeing a little store in Porter Square in Cambridge that sold Tibetan artifacts. And so I went there, and it was the end of the day, and I opened the door, and there was a elderly Nepalese man, and he said, oh, I was just shutting the store up. And I said, oh, sorry, well, I'll come back. And he said, no, come in. He was very kind. Come in. And I said, oh, I want a Buddha, you know, about this size for my mantelpiece. And he said, oh, here they, yeah, we have lots. Take your time. And then he just left me alone. And there was a Buddha that spoke to me. And so I picked it up and, you know, brought it to the counter and said, yeah, I really like this one. And he said, yeah, that's a nice one. He said, I'll give you 20% off. I don't know why he did that. He'd already made the sale. And I said, oh, great. Well, then I'll buy something else. So I saw this really nice Vajra. And I said, well, I'll take the Vajra. He said, oh, good. 30% off. And then he took some incense and he said, yeah, have this too. And I thought, wow, okay. You know, and of course, did this elderly Nepalese man remind me of Desha Rinpoche? Well, no, not really, but that, in the movie he would. But maybe kind of he did. Then as he wrapped my stuff very carefully and then he said, so put this on your altar. I wasn't going to put it on an altar. I didn't have one. I was going to put it on my mantle. Put this on your altar. And then each day bow to it and meditate. And then he started to tell me how to meditate. And yes, something rose up in me that wanted to say, I know how to meditate. I was at the San Francisco Zen Center. I think I sat with Norm Fisher a couple of times. But no. But here, this kind man who, and I saw a flyer that he offered meditation classes. So this kind, you know, elderly man who'd been a Buddhist all his life and taught meditation class was making an offering to me. So I thought, okay, I'll accept this offering. And so he gave me this very good instructions on meditation. I was listening to it, kind of internally nodding my head. Yeah, right, check. Yeah, got that, okay. And then he said something that I wasn't expecting. He said, do this 10 minutes a day, 5 minutes, 10 minutes a day. And you know, so, wow, oh my gosh, what an opening for me. I never realized you could do that. And I got in my car, and I thought, yeah, I could meditate for 10 minutes a day. I had thought that if I was going to start sitting again, I had to sit for 40 minutes. I was still in that mind. I had, you know, yeah, I'm not going to sit for 10 minutes. It's 40 minutes or bust. And I couldn't see my way to sitting for 40 minutes. I wasn't there. I had weakened myself by lots of you know, just numbing behavior, lots of drinking, lots of zoning out. I couldn't be with myself for 40 minutes. But 10 minutes I could do. Maybe he studied the Lojong teachings. Because he was a bodhisattva. So, now here's something interesting. The first, I told you I would tell you about some of the 5 points. I'll at least tell you this one. The first of the points is called strong determination. But I'm taking the strong away. Because sometimes we only have weak determination. So I'm going to say, we just need some determination. And that's all we need to ask of ourselves sometimes. And here is my really weak but crucial determination. That when I decided, I got back to my spacious, drafty apartment. And I went back to my closet. And guess what was there? My sitting cushion. From 30 years earlier. And I had lived in all these places, and some of them cramped. You don't want to hear all those stories. But I had always kept that zafu with me. I couldn't let it go. I couldn't throw it away. And that was my weak determination. And it wasn't like it was a symbol of anything. It was a cushion. And I always found a place to put it. And it was always out of sight. So I had this little loft where my kids would sleep when they came for the weekend. And when they weren't there, I would deflate their arrow beds. And now I had a little meditation room. And so I sat for 10 minutes. And something else I'd never thrown away was Shunyu Suzuki's Zen My Beginner's Mind. And I said, oh, I'll read one of his Dharma talks each morning, and then I'll sit for my 10 minutes. And I did this for about 2 weeks. And this goes to the second of the 5 strengths. There is determination, and then there's familiarization. Just do your practice. Do the slogans every day. Do your sitting every day. Read a Dharma talk every day. And it doesn't have to be a lot. And for me, it was, you know, those chapters are about 4 or 5 pages long. And 10 minutes. And two weeks. And I said, you know, I bet there's a Zen group around here someplace. I mean, you know, it's been a long time since I looked last. And so I Googled, and there was this Zen group in West Newton, with this kind of stupid name, the Henry David Thoreau Sangha, but it was part of a group with a cool name, which was Boundless Way Zen, and the teacher looked legit, this man named James Ford. We had a lineage. Oh yeah, real deal. Okay, I can do that. And so one Monday night, I went there and sat. And 600 or more Monday nights later, I'm still going. So I let the familiarity grow. I sat more and more. I started sitting at Spring Hill every Saturday morning. And this is a great teaching. You know, just keep doing it. And it's not fake it till you make it, because there's no faking Zen. You know that. You can't sit on the cushion and fake it. You have to confront it. And the more you do it, the stronger your determination grows. So these feed each other. And then all along you are being propelled by what is called the positive seed or the seed of virtue. And that's that Dharma jewelliness that, as I found out, you can cover it up, but you can't throw it away anymore. Any more than I could throw away that sofu. Yeah, all beings by nature are Buddha. You too. And then the fourth one is reproach. And both the commentaries in the Tibetan tradition and Norman Fisher say, this is really hard for Americans. Yeah, we have to be careful with Americans. Yeah, because we're kind of emotional. You may have noticed that. And we, you know, feel guilty and we reproach ourselves. But reproach basically, you know, so here's how we use reproach. We notice when we're not honoring that Dharma jewel, when we're not honoring that seed of virtue, that positive seed. And if it takes 30 years for that to happen, fine. Because, guess what? As Linji told us, we have everything we need. Nothing was ever missing. You can't lose 30 years in Zen. If you can come to this retreat just a few times in the 3 weeks, you'll get everything you need. So the reproach isn't, I'm the worst student in the Zendo. The reproach is, I'm not doing what I can. And don't try to do more than you can. But do what you can. And then the fifth one is aspiration. And so Norman Fisher said, I think I really did sit with him a couple of times. Norman Fisher says, yeah, aspiration is embodied in our bodhisattva vows. He doesn't really need to say much more than that. So let's end. Please, no bells, no chanting, just one repetition. Please just say the four bodhisattva vows with me. Beings are numberless. I bow to freedom. Delusions are inexhaustible. I bow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I bow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. I bow to embody it. So we will move into our Dharma dialogue, and please feel free to sit comfortably. And this is being recorded, and you may ask for the recording to stop at any time if you would feel more comfortable that way. And we'll start by going around and saying our names. I'm Alan.
I'm Laura.
Jenny.
Ray.
Esther.
Susan.
I'm Jen.
Matt.
Carolyn.
Mark.
Aaron.
Meg.
Michael.
Keaton.
Andy.
Celia.
Bill.
Kathy.
Cliff.
David.
Melissa.
So, questions, comments, what's coming up for you? Yeah, Nat.
Thank you for your talk, and thanks for the autobiography. So, it's hard for me to stay out of comparing mine when I hear maybe anybody's autobiography. It doesn't have to be yours. But that's what I was doing during the talk, was just trying to stay in my practice. Stay out of comparing mine. Stay, try and stop myself from directing a sample story to say, oh, you know, my life's not like that, much worse. that, you know, so that kind of thing. And today I had a lot of trouble getting to this retreat. I had to overcome a lot of resistance just to get here. And one thing that I discovered, and I guess this, I don't know where this fits in the five strengths, so that's my question, is I had to do something that I hadn't, I don't know if I'd done it before with my mind, but I had to try saying, shut up and let something else speak. So I paid attention to the sky, and when I got here, the trees, and I got to the shining floor, and I said, you know, what's this saying? What's this saying? What's this saying? And I found that I was able to just, you know, two things can't be on stage at the same time. So, you know, by giving the stage some stage to the other thing, I was able to get in the car and get here. So that's the question. I don't know where that fits in. But letting other things speak was sort of a slogan that I had to come up with myself. To get here today, and I don't know. I think I'll be practicing that today.
Beautiful. And so you know, when you were saying that, I was going to say, well, you know, it doesn't have to be one of the five strengths. These are just, but in fact, it is one of them. And so this was reproach, right? You reproach yourself. Let something else speak. And that's a beautiful example of reproach. Not putting yourself down, but just let something else speak. And wonderful example of determination. You decided to get here. So, yeah.
And you know, the other slogan that this recalls for me is one we talked about last night, ask for help. So in the tradition, it's count on the fact that there are Dharma helpers everywhere, you know, these benefactors. Count on that fact. And in your case, it was the sky and the, you know, just turning your mind in that direction was enough to motivate you. I want to have your life now. Sorry. But so it's the thing that I love about the slogans and also hate about them. They get a little hackneyed, you know. Well, I'll find a slogan for this. You know, put a bird on it. It's just this funny thing about that. And the teachings do arise from our need, from our desperation, from the very anxiety and resistance that we think is so terrible. Just facing into that, something else arose instead, and you could go in that direction. And that's the strength of your 50 years, have we been practicing together? Yeah, we have. 50 years of practice, right? From the very first moment you heard about emptiness, something started, and here you are.
And I think they're both wrong. It's neither of those two. What it truly is avoiding evil and practicing good. But just another perspective is that there are choice points. And we all have those voices that keep shouting their bad advice. Right? And we know those, and they're comfortable and familiar. Part of us knows where that road, and most of the time we go down that road. But there's some places where we really have a choice of some sort. We don't even know what it is or how to do it. So I love in that choice, shut up. I want to hear something else. I want to change the channel. And you don't know what you're going to get, what it's going to say. But in those moments, we move forward through some kind of choice point that often we don't have. We just don't have. But sometimes, shut up. I want to hear something else.
And I love that you quoted from The Journey. Right? What's the line you just used?
The voices kept, one day you woke up and knew what you had to do, though the voices kept shouting their bad advice.
Right. And that's a Mary Oliver poem. And, you know, you knew what you had to do, it starts out. And then by the end of the poem, this is the only thing you can do. And this goes right back to Alan's talk. There is some kind of weird motivation that starts us going, and we think we're off the path. That's the big joke. That I'm not practicing anymore. Once we're on the path, sorry folks, it's too late for you. And it doesn't matter when the consciousness of it returns to us. It doesn't matter. We could be gone for, you know, 80 years and then in our last breath. It's like, I can feel my breath. Oh. So why not do it now? Don't wait. And everybody who's showing up in this room, everybody listening to the recording online, is in fact practicing fully right now, has returned to this original impulse, which we thought meant something other than what it did. And it's been carrying us all this time.
Mark?
It really resonated with thing you said about you can't help but be yourself in a way. And I'm having that situation with my family and my work life as well. Like it's all coming to get me right now. All of the things. You know, I kind of built up this kind of image of who I am.
Mm.
You know, and it's hard to really show yourself, like to really be you and to confront, to confront, well, maybe this isn't the right job for me, for example, yeah. Or maybe something in my relationship with my family isn't quite right and I need to confront that. And I'm feeling that right now, where it's like, it's happening. And I don't have any answers. I don't know how is this going to go, or how, what am I
going to
do,
and you know, what I'm hearing is that, unlike me, when I was in the midst of it, you're seeing it, you're letting yourself see it for what it is, you're not, knocking back a couple of beers after work, and splitting a bottle of wine with your wife, and now time for the hard stuff. You know, you're not living that life of numbing and denial. And so this is actually, I mean, this will sound pretty facile, but to me, this is good news no matter what happens. And it's not always easy to work stuff out, and you can't always work stuff out. But doing this in a conscious way and being honest with yourself about it, and even telling us about it, really, really amazing. This is the force of this practice in you.
And I love how you say that the things of my life are coming to get me. We could say the Dharma is rising up to free you from the dream you're in. But these moments when, as you say, we all have a sense of the world and who we are and what's going on, and it's actually not true. Whatever your sense is of who you are and what's going on, that's only a small part of it. And yet we cling to that. And these difficult times, on the cushion, you sit for more than 5 minutes and the difficult times come up where the disjuncture happens, and these are the opportunities, because all of us here in some way really want to know what's going on, what's really going on, right? And there's a kind of, I think for many of us, a kind of dissatisfaction at living at the surface. It's too tiring, it's too exhausting, and so there is this hunger. And then the opportunity comes. It's, oh, no, I didn't really mean it. I want to go. your life is coming to get you in a theater nearby. the five remembrances, old age, sickness, and death. Difficulty is coming your way. And partly these Lojong teachings are encouragement for how do we transform, or how do we use the very difficult stuff? This is not like some easy thing. Oh, yeah, Mark, just do this. No, no, this is really up against it, right? For each one of us. And indeed, we are up against it anyway. Each one of us. Yeah.
Carolyn.
Thank you, Virginia. I always really love these talks where you learn more about everybody else's difficult tasks. Because all is difficult. But what particularly struck me was that, you know, this whole thing is sort of about motivation and aspirations. And yet I'm so aware, as you were describing, how easy it feels, maybe it's not real, but feels like you fall off the path. If you're motivated, you go for a while, and then you either stop doing it or you do it in a kind of mindless way, just sort of going through the forms. And sometimes, I'm hoping I'm not the only one in the room who's gone through that, finding it very hard to stick with at times. But it's also, I guess one thing I've learned more, and I think Melissa once you're on the path, you're not off it. Even when you think you're off it, even when you're not practicing regularly, there is some level of awareness, even when it comes as you're not doing what you're supposed to do, or what happened to all that, those aspirations. But it does take you to a different level of, well, why am I not doing that since it means so much to me? Or what am I actually doing instead of it? It just seems like, James always uses the word about it being a very forgiving path, and I think that's true. You need motivation, you need aspirations, and you fall off the path, and you get lost for a while, and then you come back, but even the getting lost, I think, is part of the being on the path, and that takes a long time to really absorb.
Yeah, beautifully said. And you know, I just wanted to respond to I can't add anything to what you said so well, but I did want to respond to one thing. You said sometimes you stop practicing or you keep practicing, and you said something like, but your mind's not in it or something. And you know, in the spirit of the five strengths and familiarization, I would say it better to do it in what you think is, you know, your heart's not in it, your mind's not in it, just to keep doing it. Because you don't know what's going on. You know, you think that you're sitting and nothing's happening on the cushion. But we don't know. We don't know that. So we talk sometimes in Boundless Way Zen about, faith in Zen. You know, and Zen seems like, no, there's no faith in Zen. You question everything. You know, question your teacher. But there's a faith that's not a dogmatic faith, but a faith that's born of experience. And, you know, and you've sat long enough that I think you've developed that faith that, well, just keep sitting and don't worry about if it's good Zazen or bad Zazen and see what happens. That would be my encouragement.
I had a very similar, response to that very thing. So you said it very well, Alan. But I just want to add a little bit more to it. So, you know, faith is one of the three essentials, what Philip Kaupp called the three pillars of Zen. So it's not just in Boundless Way, but it actually goes back to this Chinese guy, Gao Feng, who came up with a doubt, faith, and determination. So we heard about different varieties of determination. And I want to say that this whole thing that Alan was just pointing to about not being able to judge our own practice is so important, especially when we feel like nothing's going on. And sometimes we talk about that as being in the desert. You know, it feels so dry and dead and nothing's happening. And if we really understand that we can't judge our own practice, because we'll say, it's not doing anything for me. And there is an early stage in practice when we first start practicing. Some of you know this from just being fairly new. Oh, so wonderful. Oh, I'm so much calmer and kinder. And people in my life are telling me I'm getting feedback. And then, sorry to tell you if you're newer to the practice. That actually ends. It doesn't persist for some reason. And then why am I doing this? What am I getting out of it? And somebody said to me recently that very question, what am I getting at? I don't know why I'm doing it. This just feels useless. And I said to this person, yep, it is. And it was such a shocking response, right? Because, wait a minute, then what? And we got right into the same material. You know, when nothing is happening, you think you know that nothing is happening, but we can't know our own practice. We can't get out of our bodies and see our own eyes. It's kind of like that. So I just love that you brought this up, Carolyn, and said it so beautifully, and Alan picked up just the very point. Just wanted to elongate it a little more. Yeah, thank you very much. But keep going through that desert, right? Yeah.
And I appreciate the variation quality, because I think many of us have this idea, if it's the true path, we'll always feel the same way about it. And in fact, of course, more energy, less energy, it really makes sense, it doesn't make sense. I appreciate just calling us to what you said about there's all kinds of weather along the path, and some is very inspiring, and there are moments when I think, yeah, this really does make a lot of sense. Good use of 50 years. And then other times I think, what? I've been doing this, and this is, what am I going to, you know? And to really let all of that be part of it. It's part of this, we can't really judge. We don't. I don't know what we're doing, right? We don't really know what's going on. But it's kind of amazing, whatever it is. And we can appreciate that amazement from all different perspectives. And then there's a freedom. And the freedom is not constancy. It's not, now I am a person of Zen. You know, it's like, well, now I'm a mixed up person of Zen. Now I'm a clear person of Zen. Now, you know, but this possibility that I think we're talking about, that Alan's so wonderfully talking about, that it's all part of it. It's all this unfolding. Not one of your steps takes you away from your heart.
There's a kind of wonderful thing I just want to maybe we'll end with this and come back to our practice in a moment. But some of you know that in Boundless Way Zen, we have an option. We have so many teachers, and sometimes you find that one teacher is the one that you feel most connected to. So we do a what's called Shoken, which is committing to one teacher as your main spiritual guide, even though you keep studying with the other teachers. And the first thing you're supposed to do in Shoken is write a spiritual autobiography. And I have never received a spiritual autobiography from a potential Shoken student that doesn't sound like it was inevitable that I came to this practice. And I think every one of us could tell that story, you know, the autobiography. And yeah, Nat's right, the comparing mind comes in. Their story is so much better than my story, and et cetera. And every single story is really precious. It's complete and whole, and it ends with, and now I'm practicing here. And I think all these stories have to end there. And now I'm practicing here. And so let's practice.